Thank you so much. I have no slides, so you just have to look at me or something else. First, thanks so much to the organizers for inviting me. It's lovely to be here. And I, too, am not an economic historian. I guess all of us are here at the tail end to give you a different angle of vision on some of these questions. My paper is drawn from my forthcoming book called The Chinese Question, which is about the Chinese who participated in the great gold rushes of the 19th century and the racial politics of exclusion that arose in the Anglo-American settler societies. In this paper, I think about Chinese gold seekers as ironic historical actors in that period's global economic development. Although we cannot hold them responsible as causal agents in the trajectory of British and then US global economic and financial hegemony, I propose that we think about them as vectors of both convergence and divergence in the rise of British and American power and the weakening and isolation of China in the global economy in the 19th and early 20th century. The gold rushes of the last half of the 19th century were unprecedented in scale and consequence. From the California gold rush of 1848 to the discovery of gold in the Yukon in 1901, gold miners and gold mining companies extracted from the earth some 435 million ounces of gold, more than the total amount that had been mined in the previous 3,000 years. Perhaps 150,000 Chinese participated in the gold rushes around the world. To be sure, they were a minority of the goldfield populations, although they comprise upwards of 20 to 25% of the people in the gold districts in California and Victoria, Australia, in the 1850s and 60s. The 60,000 Chinese who went to the Transvaal between 1904 and 1910 were instrumental in the revival and expansion of industrial gold mining after the South African War. The economic historian Jean-Jacques Van Helton considered the increase in the global supply of gold a fortuitous meeting of the monetary demands posed by expanding world trade. But we might think of it more as a stimulus, a new stage of capital accumulation. Gold increased the money supply, promoted investment and trade, enabled more countries to go to a gold monetary standard, eventuating in it becoming the international monetary standard. Gold alone does not explain the rise of Great Britain and then the United States as the world's leading investor and creditor nations, but gold was definitely a brick in the road of their ascent. The participation of Chinese in the gold rushes was ironic in several respects. At the scale of broad historical sweep, they contributed to one of the great historical divergences of the period, the shift from China's commanding position in the early modern global silver trade to becoming semi-colonized by Euro-American powers in the 19th century. My point here is not to revisit the arguments for the Great Divergence circa 1800 or 1700, but to appreciate some of the consequences of the shift from the primacy of silver or bimetallism to gold in global trade. Take, for example, the war indemnities that the imperialist powers imposed on China during its century of humiliation. The settlements of the two opium wars amounted to 30 million silver dollars, or 7.5 million pounds. These penalties seriously hobbled the Qing. But consider those against the indemnities imposed by Japan after the Sino-Japanese War in 1896, 50 million pounds, and by the Boxer Protocols of 1901, 67.5 million pounds payable to the eight foreign powers. Moreover, indemnities payable in gold, which required China to sell silver on the world market at a time when its price relative to gold was falling. Notwithstanding, I want to focus mostly in this paper closer to the ground on the Chinese emigrants whose myriad activities during the gold rushes more directly influenced the changing nature of relations between China and the West. I will consider gold miners as well as merchants who were always just a half step behind them, as was the general case on the gold fields, or who were former gold miners themselves. So first, there is a matter of how much Chinese earned directly from gold mining and where those profits went. Now, this is very hard to determine with any precision because Chinese miners tended to underreport earnings, and much of the data we have are anecdotal. But for example, in Sacramento County, California, in 1860, small cooperatives of 4 to 5 members owned claims assessed on average of $2,500, with each partner earning $40 to $50 a month. And this is actually comparable to the earnings of white miners at the time. After expenses, one might save $3 a month or $30 a year to send to one's family in China. If we try to scale up, we can use other data to get a sense of Chinese economic activity in mining. For example, in 1861, in California, Chinese paid $187,000 in foreign miners' taxes, over $2 million in water charges, and $1.35 million to purchase mining claims. Some who are lucky at gold mining simply return home with their pile, as contemporaries would say. Returning Chinese often carried gold and gold dust for others, so they were also remittance carriers. For example, 18 men returning to China from New South Wales in 1857 on the ship Ethereal carried the gold of 370 others worth over 9,000 pounds. One of them carried gold divided into 72 packets, wrapped in long strips of linen, one for himself and the rest for others in or and near his home village in Guangdong province. And I will say more about remittances later. Okay, second, there's a matter of trade. The gold rush has utterly transformed trans-Pacific commerce. The Canton trade of the 18th and early 19th century had traveled through the Indian and Atlantic Oceans to Europe and to New York, and Hong Kong was still a struggling port just 7 years after its cession to Britain. The California gold rush prompted Hong Kong to pivot to the Pacific. It quickly became the premier Asian entrepot for both goods and emigrants headed for the Gold Mountains. For the year 1849 alone, 23 vessels exported from Hong Kong nearly 5,000 tons of goods to San Francisco, including rice, sugar, and tea, beer, coffee, cigars and chocolate, hats and clothing, furniture and canvas, tools and implements, timber logs and planks, window frames, bricks, marble slabs, and prefabricated wooden houses. The Chinese population of Hong Kong itself grew as nearly 8,000 people arrived in 1850, with many intending to produce goods for the California market, engaged in the shipping trade, or otherwise work in the booming port. Chinese commercial firms in Hong Kong, although not as large or powerful as the venerable British and American houses like Jardine Matheson, nevertheless became important players in the California trade and in the economy of the expanding Chinese diaspora. Many Chinese merchants on the gold fields were former miners, hiring others to work their claims while they ran a store, invested in larger mining operations, or branched out into other lines of business. But the most powerful Chinese merchants were located in the big cities. For example, Chen Lok, that's his Cantonese name, an early arrival was known by the name of his firm, Qi Lung, which in time became the largest and most famous Chinese business in San Francisco. In 1852, Qi Lung imported as much as $10,000 in Chinese goods at a time, sold it all in a few days, and returned to China for another shipment. He established branches in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Yokohama over time. He and other big merchants owned their own lots, erected their own buildings. Some merchants purchased their own ships or became shipping agents. China remained one of San Francisco's three largest trading partners at least to 1880. Chinese merchants and shippers carried passengers in both directions. They imported so-called fancy goods for white customers like silk and porcelain, and rice, tea, and opium for the growing population of Chinese immigrants. They exported wheat, flour, ginseng, and mercury, as well as Chinese miners' gold dust. By 1880, there were 25 Chinese import-export firms in San Francisco. The most prosperous were each worth $500,000. And many had seats on the city's merchant exchange, including 7 who were stockholders. So let me turn briefly to Australia, where gold was discovered in 1851, touching off the second major gold rush of the 19th century. Trade with the metropole increased exponentially, as well as sailing traffic from Hong Kong and Xiamen to Victoria. During the 1850s, Australia became the fourth largest importer of Chinese tea, consumed not just by Chinese immigrants, but by British colonials as well. Lo Kang Meng was arguably the most powerful Chinese man in Victoria. Unlike the Chinese merchants in California, whose trade ran bilaterally between San Francisco and Hong Kong, Lo's interests nested in broader overlapping networks of Chinese and British commerce in Asia. He was born to a Cantonese merchant on Penang Island in the British Strait Settlements. His family had been settled there for over 100 years, long before the arrival of the British in the late 18th century. In 1853, Low traveled from Mauritius, where he was tending to his family's business, to Victoria. After a few months of unsuccessful gold prospecting, he went to Calcutta and brought back to Melbourne a shipment of goods. He founded Kang Mang and Company, an import firm. Soon he would own a half dozen ships. He imported mainly from Calcutta and Penang and Singapore, rice, tea, opium, sugar, and other foodstuffs. He was a major agent of credit tickets, the main way by which Chinese financed their passage to Australia. He was an investor and founding director of at least a half dozen companies, including a distillery and several gold and silver mining companies. He held shares in insurance companies and banks and was a founding shareholder and board member of the Commercial Bank of Australia, founded in 1866. Eventually, his business network extended to mining and mercantile ventures in New South Wales, Queensland, the Northern Territory, and New Zealand. His business dealings reveal an important distinction in the opportunities Chinese faced in California and Victoria. Although California banks also did business with Chinese, notably the Wells Fargo and Company, no American corporation welcomed Chinese capital. Moreover, Lo Kang Meng was part of a Southeast Asian Chinese elite who were confident in their identity of belonging within both the British Empire and the Chinese diaspora. Merchant leaders held positions of authority in Chinese native place and clan associations, and as such, they were spokesmen for Chinese to Euro-Americans, especially in response to racial discrimination and animus. In Australia, Lo Kang Meng was a leader in both the San Yi Hui Guan, the Native Place Association for people from the three counties around Guangzhou, and the Yixing, which was part of the Zhigong Tang, the anti-Manchu secret brotherhood society that spread across the Chinese diaspora in the middle and late 19th century. In both the U.S. and Australia, Chinese merchant leaders sent delegations to meet with white officials, wrote letters to the newspapers, and published pamphlets that refuted Chinese racial stereotypes, emphasized their positive contributions to society, and appealed to Euro-Americans for justice and equal treatment. They also consistently raised the argument that restricting immigration would damage trade. As early as 1852, Chinese merchants wrote to the governor of California. Knowing that your country wishes to trade with China, they argued that trade, quote, cannot all be in one side. The gold we have been allowed to dig in your mines is what has made the China trade grow up so fast, like everything else in this country. If you want to check immigration from Asia, you will have to do it by checking Asiatic commerce, unquote. Nearly 50 years later, the Chinese ambassador to the United States, Wu Tingfang, wrote in the North American Review that immigration and trade were matters of mutual helpfulness and called for true reciprocity in U.S.-China relations. But if the notion that exclusion harmed trade was a fixture in the debates over the Chinese question, there has actually been little examination of the actual effects of exclusion laws on commerce and trade. So in the rest of my talk, I want to address that question. And this is complex and multidimensional, as exclusion had both direct and indirect effects on global trade and commercial relations in different realms of economic activity and at different scales. So let's take first the Chinese immigrant merchants and small capitalists whose activities I have just described. The exclusion laws adversely affected them in myriad ways. Exclusion meant a shrinking population, which meant a shrinking ethnic market. There were discriminations and harassments, such as San Francisco's ban against walking on a sidewalk with a pole on one's shoulder. In 1897, the U.S. Immigration Bureau expanded the definition of laborer, who would be excluded, and narrowed the definition of merchant, an exempt class. After Chinese exclusion became permanent in 1902, a merchant named Li Chu wrote, quote, "How can I call this my home, and how can anyone blame me if I take my money and go back to my village in China?" Unquote. The San Francisco newspaper editor, Wu Panzhao, claimed that, quote, "Because of the injustice, all of the great Chinese merchants who formerly paid one-third of the customs duties at the port of San Francisco have gone back to China or do business in other countries." In Australia, Chinese capitalists had invested in mining and plantation agriculture in the far north in the 1870s, But by the turn of the century, these opportunities narrowed as immigration restrictions constrained the availability of Chinese labor upon which they depended. The Australian historian Paul Griffith argues that the elite Anglo-Australian interest chose to destroy the economy of the Northern Territory rather than let Chinese develop it. Queensland, with substantial capital already invested in agricultural development, hired whites to replace Chinese and Pacific Islander laborers on plantations with higher wages subsidized by the government. Cooktown, which had thrived as a port connecting northern Queensland to Singapore and Hong Kong, declined after 1890. And in Melbourne and other southern cities, Chinese remained confined to the ethnic market with just a few niches that served non-Chinese consumers like garden farming and furniture making. With fewer economic activities in the United States and in the British settler colonies, Chinese labor and merchant emigrant energies directed elsewhere. Migration from southern China to Southeast Asia dramatically increased after 1870, 16 million between 1891 and 1938. I get this figure from Sukhara, and 14 million from India. Although Chinese had settled in the Nanyang for hundreds of years, as Lo Kang Meng's family exemplified, the late 19th and early 20th century booms in tin mining and rubber production for European industrial markets required ever larger numbers of workers, and they were recruited from long-established trade and labor networks. We also see migration from northern China to Manchuria from 1890s to World War II at comparable scale in response to Russian and Japanese industrial and mining development in the region. So exclusion resulted first in greatly diminished economic activities for Chinese merchants and capitalists in the West, and second in the concentration of Chinese labor and mercantile emigration to Southeast Asia and North Asia. The first did not directly cause the second, but neither are the two trends merely coincidental. Both were integral to a broad reorganization of global migration in the early 20th century. British settler immigration to the white dominions, East and Southern European emigration to the industrializing centers of the Americas, and Asian migrations to the colonial economies of Southeast and North Asia. This new ethno-racial pattern of migration was not simply a spontaneous response to labor and capital market demands. Rather, they resulted from a confluence of political and economic measures that directed labor and commercial energies in certain directions and not in others. These included negative policies like Chinese exclusion, as well as positive policies such as deliberate British efforts to divert emigration from the United States to Canada and the other dominions, and the tireless work of industrialists, agriculturalists, labor agents, and shipping companies to recruit labor from Europe to the Americas, from India and China to Southeast Asia, and Chinese to North Asia. Okay, I'm going to skip the part about tea and conclude with some additional comments. Well, let me just say this about tea. I mean, China's exports of tea plummet in the late 19th century, and we talked about that a little bit yesterday. But I just want to point out that Australia is amazing in how far it would go in its racial, the racial basis of its policies. Value of Chinese tea exports to Australia plummeted after 1886, when at the height of anti-Chinese agitation. And a contemporary noted that hostility towards China outweighed all other considerations, including those of a commercial nature. The Australian colonies also similarly refused to participate in the Anglo-Japan Treaty of 1896, which would have opened a lucrative Japanese market to Australian wool on account of that treaty's provision for free Japanese emigration. Okay, so let me conclude with some comments on emigrant remittances. Contemporary observers, Qing customs officials, and Western economists in the early 20th century remarked on the scale of overseas Chinese remittance. The Qing diplomat Huang Zunxian believed remittances from California in the 1880s to be about 1.2 million a year, a credible estimate if just a quarter of the population in California sent $30 home in a year. In 1903, Jose Amores of the Chinese Maritime Customs House considered, quote, China's most important invisible asset to be her export of brawn and brains in the emigration of a portion of her redundant population, whether as traders or laborers, unquote. He quoted Fujian customs commissioners who called attention to the cash assets derived from remittance, including those made by 2.5 million men who are earning money in Manila, Java, and the Straits, amounting to over 10 million silver dollars a year, or 1.95 million pounds. Morse calculated Chinese remittances to be at least 73 million taels a year, or about 11 million pounds. Including that figure in China's assets for 1903, Morse calculated that China's assets exceeded its liabilities, a modest net surplus in its balance of trade. Now, I won't go into this here, but these accounting structures are somewhat arbitrary, and they also omit all Hong Kong trade because there are no customs data for that. But the point is that he's trying to make a point about the importance of remittance. And Morse was not the only analyst to credit overseas Chinese remittance for balancing China's trade accounts. The economist C.F. Riemer of the University of Michigan, writing in 1933, believed some 4 to 5 million overseas Chinese, perhaps 60% of the total emigrant population, regularly sent remittance home to China. He revised Morse's figures upward based on his own investigation of bank records to arrive at an estimated average annual remittance of 50 million U.S. dollars per year for the period 1902 to 1913. He acknowledged that the small remittances of individual laborers from laundrymen in America to rubber workers in Malaysia constituted a considerable amount in the aggregate. But the great sums, he said, are remittances of business profits and of income from property holdings, especially in Southeast Asia. Remittance supported a transnational culture that sustained emigrant family ties and subsistence. Sending monies home fulfilled familial obligations and raised the standard of living and social status of emigrants' families in towns and villages. In the late 19th century, $30 bought enough rice and small necessities for a small family for a year. In addition to household maintenance, remittances built houses, schools, libraries, roads, hospitals, and railroads. The people of Kaiping County in Guangdong lined the roads leading into their county with fortified watchtowers to repulse bandits attracted by the wealth of remittance families, and this is now a UNESCO site. The prosperity of emigrant sending regions in Guangdong and Fujian provinces testified to the power of overseas remittance. Riemer noted, quote, "The Chinese have built up business investments abroad with practically no outpayments from China. These investments bring into China payments from outside, which are of the greatest importance in her balance of payments," unquote. Thus, even as exclusion policies shut Chinese out of the social and economic mainstream in the West, the emigrants carried gold dust home in the linings of their jackets and sent foreign exchange through remittances. One of the greatest ironies, perhaps, of the Chinese question is that overseas Chinese in the United States, Australia, and Southeast Asia held on to their savings and remitted large amounts to China when the price of silver dropped. Thank you.